The roll call then. Harold Alvestrand. Doc, I believe I heard you.
Yes, I'm very much here still.
Neha Gupta, I presume Neha is still on her honeymoon?
She'll be very soon in the States. I believe she's got a visa, but I think she'll be in Illinois or somewhere. I don't think she'll be able to join in Los Angeles. I don't know what her plan is.
Okay. Tharmad,
but I think she'll join by remote.
Oh, good. Thank you. Tharmad, I heard your voice on the call.
Yes, I'm here.
Manal, I heard you on the call.
And yes.
I'll just call in.
Manal, thank you for that. Who's that voice that came in there?
Harald just called in.
Hello,
Harald. Sorry for being late.
No problem. Welcome. Next, I have Ashka Joshi, but I presume he's not available?
No, I think he'll be joining in. He has joined office. He said he'd ring up from office. I gave him the numbers to call India, ABC, and the numbers.
Hi, this is Akshat. I have already joined.
Ah, there he is.
Ah, good. Thank you. Excellent. Kerry, I heard your voice.
Yes, indeed.
Mahesh Kulkarni. Xiaodong Li.
I think he'll try and join in, but I'm not very sure.
Okay. Evangelos Melagrakis. Alexei Mikhailov, I heard your voice.
Yes, I'm here.
Panagiotis Paspilopoulos.
I'm here. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, Panagiotis. Welcome. Vagelis, I heard your voice earlier. Vagelis, are you on the call?
Yes, yes. Sorry, I was muted.
Thank you. No problem. James Singh. Vladimir Shudrinov.
I'm on the call.
Alexei Sozanov. And Joseph Yi. I think I heard your voice, Joseph.
I'm here.
Thank you. Edmund Chung. Is Edmund on the call? No. And on the ICANN team, I've heard Francisco, you're on the call. Kim, is Kim on the call?
Yes, I am.
Thank you, Kim. Bahir, I heard you on the call. Julie, is
yes,
Julie
I am.
On the call? Is Julie on the call? I'm on the call. Patrick, I think I heard you earlier.
Yes, I'm here.
Haley, I heard you. Karen, are you on the call?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you, Karen. Nicholas is not available. Is it Kurt is on the call? Yes, Kurt, still here?
Yep, I can hear.
Thank you. Naila Saras?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you, Naila. Steve Sheng? Steve hasn't joined us. Andrew Sullivan?
I'm here.
Thank you, Andrew. Leo Vigoda? Okay, excellent. Thank you very much indeed. Now, I'll say again what I said earlier, which is to congratulate everybody and thank everybody in the case study teams, and please convey my thanks for all the work done in the analysis and the summary of the public comments. All those reports are now in, and that's a tremendous piece of work. Thank you very much indeed for that, and please pass on my thanks to the teams. Now, the minutes and action items from last week. Haley, do you have the actions in front of you, and can you go through them for us?
Okay, this is from the 23rd of November, correct?
That's correct, yes.
These were to update the visual similarity document based on today's discussion. Is Steve on the call? I'm sorry, I didn't hear if he was or not.
Steve isn't on the call at the moment, so I'm pretty sure Steve has done that, so let's move on. Let's mark that as done.
Okay, Andrew and Nicholas was to finalize the taxonomy document during the next week.
Yeah. Andrew, that's done, isn't it?
Andrew said he had to step away for a minute.
Thanks, Nayala. I think I'm pretty certain that's done. Next, Haley.
Karen, let's update the evaluation document with text regarding fees.
Could you say that again? You're a bit muffled, I'm afraid. I can't hear you properly.
So Karen was to update the evaluation document with text regarding fees.
Right.
Yes, I did that.
Thank you. Thank you, Karen. Next.
Dennis, you were to put the SAMAD list of issues that's going to need to be discussed on the agenda for next week and start a discussion on the mailing list.
I think that's done.
Okay, and then Steve was to check with the Chinese team to confirm that the team will be able to submit the reply on time.
And that certainly has been done because the document is gone, has come in.
Okay, and that was it. That's all five action items.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed. Okay. Now, Naila, any update on the December face-to-face meeting?
Thank you, Dennis. The only update I have is Manel, as Manel reported, she's able to join the meeting, so that's excellent. Everyone who is traveling should have received their hotel booking information from Joseph. And unless anyone has questions for us, I think Joseph is staying on top of the details and getting everyone what they need to know before they get to LA. So we're all just looking forward to a good meeting. Unless you guys have questions, I don't have anything else to report.
Thank you very much, Naila. Again, your line is pretty poor. I'm having difficulty hearing you. So let me just repeat. Has anybody got any comments or questions about the face-to-face meeting? Okay, hearing none. It looks like, Naila, we're well on the way to a meeting in Marina Del Rey. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda, and I have no comments on the mail list to suggest we should change the agenda, so I'm working through the draft I circulated. Next item on the agenda is establishing cold point repertoires. Andrew, over to you if you're back on the call. Not hearing Andrew. Andrew? No. Let's go on to the next item on the agenda and come back to that, which is visual similarity. Steve, there's been a discussion on the list. Where? Oh, no, Steve isn't on the call. Oh, that's unfortunate. Francisco, is anybody able to pick this up, or should we leave this for another day?
Perhaps I can try.
Oh, thank you, if you would.
So, on this topic, on visual similarity, I sent an email yesterday. Steve, Doc, Sarmad, and I had a chat and talked about the issue. We agree that there are the types of categories of variants. The first one, well, if you remember, there's an email from Sarmad describing the six broad categories of variants. He's talking about the using three different variables. The first one is where the two cold points are linguistically related, meaning they are the same master character. And please, Armand, if I'm saying something that is wrong, please correct. The other two variables are where the shapes are the same. The last one is where the shapes are similar. In that sense, we were thinking that there are two lines that can be drawn here, and we agree on that. Please, the first line will be drawn between categories number 3 and number 6, meaning basically, I'm sorry, between 3 and 4, which meaning we are encompassing categories 1, 2, and 3, which are the ones that have the first variable equal to. Meaning the two code points are the same abstract character. They have a linguistic relationship. And for those variants, we were thinking that means they they have some equivalence relationship, and as such, they can be providing the some rules are established. They can be allocatable. They can be delegated. They can be activated in DNS in general. And there is another set which encompasses categories 4 and 5. These are the categories in which the two code points are not linguistically related, but only are either the shape are exactly the same or they are very similar. And in those cases, we were thinking that those two broad categories can be, you know, the type of variants that will only get blocked. They will never be allocated, delegated, activated, and not even reserved. They will only be blocked. And of course, we have the last broad category, which is actually not variants. Those are just any other pair of code points. So that was the conversation we had. We agree on that. What we agree is how to consider those, because I was saying that basically categories 4 and 5 would be pure visual similarity, and I was proposing that those were not treated as variants. We have already a process that can handle those. But that was the state of the conversation. We didn't have more time to continue talking about this. So I would like to ask what you think about this idea of having the categories, these broad categories, saying that the first tree in which there is a linguistic relationship, we can consider those types of variants to be reservable, allocatable, delegatable, activatable, etc. Is that something that people agree? And the second part is what are the categories 4 and 5 are the ones that are only blockable? And I would like to open the for discussion on this issue.
Thank you, Francisco, and well gone through. Sarmad, do you want to come in first of all, and then I'll take whoever else wants to come in? Sarmad?
I actually don't have much more to add. I think Francisco has done a good job summarizing our discussion. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you. Anybody else want to comment on this?
Hi. Yes, this is Manal.
I have Manal. I have somebody else as well. Who else is there?
As well.
Say again, sorry. Shadow.
Alexei Sazonov.
Oh, Alexei, sorry. Yes. First of all, Manal.
I just want to seek clarification. Are we basing our criteria on the linguistic relationship, meaning that we're considering two strings that are related from a linguistic point of view, even if their shapes are different? I mean, it's category 3 that's confusing me, which is, I don't have the categories in front of me, but it was belonging to the same linguistic entity, but the shapes are different. So are we considering this a variant that could be delegated, allocated, activated, or whatever, whereas we're considering things that do not belong to the same linguistic entity but are similar? Those are not variants, are not visual. I mean, I'm a bit confused here.
This is Francisco. The first question about category number 3, which is entities that are the same, that have a linguistic relationship but their shapes are different. That's correct. That's a type of variant. I remember the Chinese report. Yeah, that happens a lot, I understand, in the script, they have traditional and simplified forms of the same abstract character, and they don't necessarily look alike. So this is a clear case of variant of category number 3. So they certainly have to be considered as variants, at least for the Chinese case. I'm not sure if this case applies for Arabic, but certainly on Chinese, that's the reason to have number 3. And I'm sorry, I forgot the other question.
Can I respond, Daniel?
Yes, please, Manuel. Go ahead.
Which I don't mind to. I don't mind having number 3 as a variant, but I'm a bit confused that we don't have things that don't belong to the same linguistic entity, but they are identical, or, I mean, they look exactly the same. Those are not variants. And now I'm talking from a pure definition point of view, regardless how we are going to handle this later on. I mean, is the main criteria the linguistic relationship, or is there any visual relationship also?
This is Francisco. I think the way to look at variants has to be in multiple dimensions. And one of those has to be linguistic, I think. The others being user experience, DNS, security, and probably others that I can't think of right now. But linguistic is something very important. One of the main reasons why you have variants is because they have some linguistic relationship. So you need to consider that. And the visual part, I don't see why is this that important. The way I'm seeing this is if you have two code points that have shapes that are similar, you don't confuse them, or you don't have an equivalent relationship unless there is something else behind, like a linguistic relationship between them. And the example that I was giving by lack of a better one is the letter lower caps L in Latin script and number 1, which in some fonts can have exactly the same shape, but there is no reason why a user would confuse them, because in a string they will know which one is being used. So that's the case in which shapes can be very similar, even exactly the same depending on the font, but you would not consider this to be in some kind of equivalence relationship. So you can talk about this as category either 4 or 5 in the post from Sarmat, or you can see it in the way I was posing that these are simply not variants and they are just a case of visual similarity.
Dennis, can you put Carrie in the queue, please?
I can.
Yes, and I'd like to come in the queue as well. This is Sarmat.
All right. So I have now Alexei. Please go ahead.
Yes, I would like to refer to John Klenzen's comments for Latin and Cyrillic team. And in these comments, he said that the variant is as it was defined, and RFC 3743 is reflected only in the report in the Chinese case. So it used to be meant for only Chinese cases. So now basically, and in this report, John Klenzen saying, just don't use this term until you well define it between themselves. I was commenting on his comments. So now I think what Francisco's done is just a great job of defining all this for non-Chinese characters, because it used to be created for different Chinese signs, which means the same. Yeah, this is it.
Thank you, Alexei. Carrie?
Yeah, I just note that we spent quite a bit of time defining homoglyph because of the need for a term that designated some concept relevant to our work that crossed language and script boundaries. And now that entire thing has just been set aside. There's a question mark after that. I'm not sure I think that's a good or a bad idea, but I'm wondering if we're going to end up regretting not having some slot somewhere where it's not simply elements of a same linguistic entity that are our concern, but also elements of a same displayed entity. Because when you look at a bunch of squiggles on your screen, there's no reason why you should have any language attribute of them in mind at all. So what do we do with a random sequence of glyphs, which is not supposed to have any linguistic association whatsoever, compared to another random sequence a sequence of code points that is represented as a sequence of glyphs that is identical to a sequence of glyphs that is used to represent another sequence of code points. Again, in a label situation where the concept of language is just not there. I realize that we've stipulated that there is some putative language attribute to every single domain name, but I think that's quite a leap from the RFC frame of reference. I'd actually like to hear Andrew comment on that. That's a request for comment.
Thank you, Kerry. Andrew, do you want to pick that up?
Sure. If there is a language tag to be associated with every name at registration time, it's only at registration time and not at lookup time. So it's true that you can do a lot of good by adding a tag to registration in order to identify the linguistic rules that you intend the label to exhibit. What you cannot do under those circumstances is assume that the label is only going to be looked up in those linguistic circumstances. And I'm speaking here specifically about the root zone. Because in the root zone, you must anticipate that people are going to encounter those labels in contexts outside of the one that you presume to be the linguistic target of the label. It's a little different, I think, in targeted domains, in domains further down the tree, or in ccTLDs where you have a reasonable apprehension of the likely users of the domain, and therefore you've got a pretty good guess about what their language is going to be. But in the case of the root zone, and we've been over this ground a little bit in the past, that you have an association of a language at registration time is a hint about the kinds of uses that you expect that thing to be used with. But I think that it's only a hint, and I think very, very importantly, we have to expect that the rules for other users of the same code points are going to have to affect the rules that you can expect to be applied to the label, and so we may be. Foreshadowing the discussion that we were, I guess, going to have, except that I was on the phone, about establishing the code point repertoire. So maybe when we come back to that, we can expand on this a little bit.
Thanks, Andrew. Sarma, do you want to come in on this conversation?
Yes, I actually probably wanted to go back to Manal's comment and then Francisco's earlier explanation. So what we are actually saying is that we are not really drawing a line at 3, but we are actually drawing a line at 5, which means that all characters which are either linguistically same or, if not linguistically same, glyphically same or similar, so the concept of alloglyphs is still there, Kerry, they are all variants. But we are saying that inherently these variants can then be subdivided into two kinds. One which are activable or allocatable, and these are the variants which come from a same which represent the same linguistic entity. And then there's another subset of variants which look similar, but they do not represent the same linguistic entity, and therefore they cannot be allocated as variants, but they will be blocked. So there'll be preventive registration sort of done in those cases. So we're still saying there are all the five levels are variants, but within variants there are two kinds of subcategories. And that sort of, I think, addresses probably Manal's concern. So it's different from saying that only level 3 are variants and then others are confusingly similar. We're trying to do away with that terminology. At least that's what we were, at least I was suggesting in our call with Steve and Doc and Francisco yesterday. I hope that perhaps clarifies some of these things a little bit more.
Thank you, Sarmad. Anybody else want
Dennis,
to...
Dennis, can I get in line, please?
And who's that?
This is Doc here.
Doc, please, go ahead, Doc, and then
yeah.
I'm going to close this and continue this on the list.
Yeah. I just wanted to say one thing, or rather two remarks. One is I'm coming back to number 3 in the table. Same linguistic entity, different shape. Sometimes it so happens that in Unicode, the entity is the same. But, for example, in Devanagari, we have two characters which represent the same linguistic entity, but the shapes of the two are different because they're used in two different languages. So this is practically a violation of Unicode's own rule that you will not permit alloglyphs of a given code point or a given abstract character and represent them and allocate different code points in the code page or the code block. That was the first remark. Now I'm coming back to the problem of linguistic entity. The way I see it is something like a generative model. The linguistic entity is the underlying abstraction, and what comes on top is what we call in generative grammar a kind of surface structure. So the linguistic entity is absolutely essential. It ties the surface structure, or the display as we call it in computeries. It ties the display to the deep structure or to what we call the storage mechanism. So I agree with Sarmad that the linguistic entity, and whether it's same or different, is something very crucial for us. Squiggles do mean something to people if they are aware of what that squiggle means. That is what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Doc. I think I heard somebody else wanting to come in.
Yes, Alexei Mikhailov.
Alexei, please.
Yes, no, I just wanted to clarify. So let's say a country or, the language community would like to apply for a variant which is number 6, different linguistic entity and different shape. Prohibit it from registration, or what would happen?
Who can answer that question? Francisco?
I'm sorry, I missed the question.
Alexei, could you repeat the question?
Yes, well, basically, during initial discussions, there were no limitations on variants in terms of linguistic entity or shape. Basically, it was, I understood it initially that we are talking that we have a, language variant table, whatever is a part of this table are called variants, right? And, variants could be as well comprised of multiple characters, for example. So right now, there is a certain categorization of that. And if a country, let's say, applies for something that, in this category corresponds to number 6, so different linguistic entity, different shape, what would be, will it be prohibited from registration?
No. Is it Harald? May I comment?
Yes, Harald. Please come in.
So, in my opinion, the answer version 6 is, no, these are two different applications, strings. Please send in two different applications and argue that they are not confusable. So if there's no linguistic relationship and no shape relationship, then they are two different strings. End of story.
But,
you know, when a language community or, you know, whoever applies for a variant rule, you know, they're not necessarily apply for strings, right? They apply for variant rule in their, you know, in their code point block.
This is Samad. I'd like to come in.
Samad, go ahead.
I think this could be... Alexei is quite right that initially we started with the proposition that variants are those things which are defined so in a language table, language variant table. But I think one thing to realize is that when a community is putting something in the language variant table, it is motivated either by the linguistic similarity or the shape similarity. So these things are still tied together. They're not really independent of each other. That was the first comment. And the second comment was that when we're saying they're linguistically similar, the reference is actually not to a language but to a script community. So linguistic is not really language per se. It's actually how languages which use the script actually behave as far as characters are concerned. So there are two characters which could be similar, and if within a script they are similar, many of the languages, so in, for example, Arabic case, Urdu and Persian and Arabic, and many of the languages actually behave very similarly as far as different characters and their similarities are concerned. So this thing is not language dependent when we say linguistic. It is actually script dependent. Thank you.
Thank you, Samad. I think this is an appropriate moment, Andrew, to go back to our previous point, which is establishing code point repertoires. Would you like to take that up?
Sure. So I sent an email, last week, about this topic, in which we had a few. We broke the issues down into three, and after that, we had a little bit of exchange on the list. And I sent an update about this after talking to Dennis on the phone last week. And the update was essentially to suggest a mechanism by which option two, so just to refresh everybody's memory, option one was you get teams together and they specify all of the rules for a given script, and every label has to be in exactly one script. And then we have a problem of, a number of different languages. I would guess pretty much everyone in the world has some code points that are outside of the main script that they use. So that could be problematic. Option two was to do this, but only for things that people actually applied for. So you had this sort of standing committee that was always invoked every time every time a new code point in a script was applied for, but other than that, you didn't talk at all about code points that you didn't have any requests for. And option three was a sort of more radical one where anybody could create a list of code points, and these would somehow have to be combined using some sort of algorithm. And this prevented the problems of ICANN ruling on linguistic use of code points, but it had the problem that there is an attack open where somebody could register a whole bunch of restrictive rules in order to prevent anybody else's variants. So those were the three options. And then I had this conversation with Dennis, and I posted then to the list in response to a question from Harold, I believe. Well, there's another option sort of in between two and three, and this option is to have these sort of standing committees, but they are they prepare sort of initial lists of code points, not necessarily all in one script, but how you use these code points with a given language tag. They sort of prepare in advance repertoires of characters that could be used and an identifier for that repertoire. And then if anybody comes along and requests anything outside of that, then that person is responsible for paying for all of the experts that would be necessary in order to evaluate this additional item. And I suggested that an approach something similar to the approach used by the Registry Services Technical Evaluation Panel could happen, so that you'd have this standing committee of experts sort of sitting there ready to go, and then you impanel an expert group at the time of one of these requests, and they're paid some fixed amount of money for, you know, 6 weeks of work or something like that, and they set to work and they do this, and the applicant for the, in the case of the RSTEP, the applicant for the service is on the hook for the cost of that. And similarly here, the applicant for the additional code point would be on the hook for the cost of setting up this extension or addition to a repertoire. Now, the key thing here would be that that, you know, sort of at the beginning of this, of course, some reasonably well-known repertoires, things that we understand or whatever, would have to be prepared kind of in advance. We've got something to start with. But apart from that, that would be the mechanism. And the idea here is that the repertoire lists all of the code points that can be used with a given, I'm going to call it a language tag, but it's really just an arbitrary identifier. So that's one thing. And then the second thing is they'd also be responsible for generating any variant rules that come out of that. So this is sort of the mechanism here is somewhat similar to the outline that I sent when we were in Dakar, that we've got this idea of having a repertoire and a rule set, and they work together. So you always generate sort of one complete set, but and if you got sort of cross repertoire conflicts, then you'd always resolve in favor of blocking. But I don't anticipate that there would be a lot of that, just because we would, you know, we would have this coordination piece to it that wasn't envisaged in that previous thing, which is more or less what option three was. So does that cover everything? Was that even remotely comprehensible? And are there any questions?
Can Carrie comment?
Thank you, Andrew. I think it was. Carrie, you're on the list.
This is actually just a suggestion about how to move this forward. The RSTEP is an attribute of the GTLD contractual process. And given that a lot of the requests that we're going to be receiving are going to come from governments or perhaps CC operators, it probably wouldn't be a good idea to tell them that we are invoking a mechanism that has its origins in a contractual regimen from which you are traditionally freed. If nothing else, the one likely response is going to be, well, we also traditionally request that any fees that ICANN might impose be waived for us. Instead, the request should be for the presentation that, yes, there's the standing committee, and, yes, additional linguistic expertise will be necessary, and since it's your request that makes it necessary, you're going to have to provide that expertise. But there are two modes of doing it. The one is we'll find it, and you will reimburse the costs of that, or you can locate such a person, and as long as the standing committee is comfortable with that contribution, that doesn't matter. What we need is the expertise.
So two things about that. The first thing is I'm using the RSTEP as a model for our purposes, just because it's something that I think people already have enough of understanding of that I can point to it. But I think you're right that in any report, we don't want to talk about the RSTEP or anything like that, because it's just a distraction. The point here is just that's the rough model. The second thing is, in respect to the fees, I agree with you, there's an issue here. The basic thing that I would say about that, however, is if a country were contributing such an expert, it wouldn't be enough for it to be only that expert, because, of course, what you need are also experts from other users of the same range of code points. So this thing still needs essentially an overarching rule that if people introduce in their repertoires various conflicts, the answer is nobody gets it. I think that we still need that safety valve there, because there's always a possibility it wouldn't even necessarily be malicious. It could just be an accident. And we need to make sure that we can't have rules that cause a variant to be generated for a given code point when one repertoire is used, but it's not generated when another repertoire is used, because this is one zone file, and so what you've got to have is the union of all of the repertoire or all of the rule sets once you're done.
That makes perfect sense, every single word of it. But I can still imagine a political...
I've never heard anybody say that about anything I've said.
But I can imagine a political entity saying that, fine, it makes perfect sense to us too, but...
Right.
And then there's the kind of but that makes anybody, such as I can, very uncomfortable.
Yes, the analogy, Dennis here, the analogy I have here is that... The realities are that you cannot have two airplanes in the same space at the same time. It's not a good idea, so let's talk about it. But that's just my trying to be witty. I hear a voice in the background. Who's that?
You can hear Carrie's, too. If you.
Is that Manal?
This is Manal.
Yes, Manal, please go.
Yes. I agree with Kelly that this is might be a problem and might put language communities from developing countries at a disadvantage. Again, I'm not sure how big a fee would be, but again, in principle, this might cause some problems.
This is Sarmad. I'd like to get in the queue.
Sarmad, come in, please.
Carrie's in the queue too, please.
Sure, Carrie. Sarmad?
Okay, so this is... I raised a couple of points on email in response to Andrew's email. and one point was actually that most of the main or more common languages are going to come in first and get their repertoires done. So, and that's what's mainly going to be covered in the first go, which is going to be now apparently free of cost. And then when one of those languages come in which use one of those characters which are not used by the main languages, set of languages, and these are exactly the languages which are spoken by more marginalized communities, in a way. Marginalized, I mean, because these are languages which are spoken by communities which have very few number of speakers or are from a developing region. So these are communities which are more financially challenged than the communities which are sort of speaking these languages with more speakers. And unfortunately, the way it's structured, it's these marginalized communities which end up paying for the fees, and the non-marginalized ones not paying for the fees. So it's sort of creates an additional barrier for the languages which we would like to sort of come online. If we do go in this direction, I think we may want to put in a recommendation that ICANN has this assistance program, and there should be some way of those communities to sort of use that assistance which is being provided for the GTLD program to...
Harald wants to get the link.
Thanks, Harold. Okay, continue, Sarmad.
So that was the first point. And the second point is that if you're asking the countries to propose or applicants to propose their own panel, then it creates a conflict of interest. So that should be avoided.
Indeed.
Thank you.
Carrie, I have next. Carrie?
Okay. There are two things. Analogies can easily be flawed. And we're talking about a situation where there is no plane in the air, and two people say, we would like to take off. And yes, indeed, only one of them can be given permission to take off. So to avoid conflict, neither of them gets permission to take off. The stronger of the two may not accept that as an answer, and the stronger of the two may have the clout to see to it that they get to take off anyway. But the problem is that exactly as Andrew was addressing a situation where somebody can block somebody else's initiative by making up a whole bunch of rules that simply block the other person or the other entity, that propagates exactly into the situation that we're talking about. We really don't want to take off, but we don't want to see you take off, so we're going to request takeoff permission too, and that way neither of us gets off, which is exactly what we want anyway.
Thanks, Gary. Harold?
And so, let me see. So this is a traditional debate. Someone says someone needs to pay for it. Someone else says, let the applicant pay for some value of applicant. Someone else says that the applicant will be poor and can't afford it, and the thing goes downhill from there. I'm sorry, this is not realistic. The realistic scenario is that for any applicant that really wants to be within a defined linguistic context, he'll find some label he can use that has characters from one script only. What will happen is more likely to happen, is that some well-endowed and powerful applicant decides that the rules as they stand are not satisfactory to him and goes to change them. In that case, I have absolutely no objection to extracting fees from that applicant. Now, this has to be crafted in diplomatic language, or we will have this discussion over and over and over again, as we have had in so many other contexts. Matters of principle with the GAC, needy applicants however they are defined. But I do believe that this is fundamentally a red herring, as long as we say that by default there are we have said that labels consisting of characters from a single script are okay, unless we have reason to believe otherwise. Thank you.
Thank you, Harold. Andrew, I think you wanted to come in.
Yes, thank you. On the topic of this issue with money, I have two things to say. The first is, this is a sort of rough sketch, and all we're trying to do, of course, is expose an issue and propose a way, some possible solutions. This is not the only way forward. The exact details of the funding model are, I think, completely outside of the scope of our report, and we don't have to worry about that. But we can suggest there are analogies to use, and that's all we need to say. I was suggesting this for our clarity so that we had a concrete picture in mind, but I think that the details of how this would be paid for are perhaps not really our central concern. But the second thing that I want to say, and I think this is very, very important to remember, when we say that a language community needs some character or code point, and that it's not covered by an existing repertoire, if it's a single code point, it would be remarkable. I mean, I'm not going to say it will never happen, because it does, but it would be remarkable if that community actually needed that code point to write meaningful labels. I mean, if you had a complete repertoire of untouched code points, it would be a big operation. But most of the time, most of the repertoires that we would generate at the beginning are going to be cases where some of those code points are in fact usable by other people anyway. We want a mechanism that discourages innovation in this area. And the reason we want that mechanism is because if the variant rules change, we have a large number of grandfather rules that we have to implement, and that is just as bad for users as anything else, right? If sometimes a code point can be written in two ways, and in other cases it turns out that you go to some other place because you weren't expecting that, but it turns out that was something that was in the root beforehand, then that's a bad thing too, and we need to make sure that the occasions for that to happen are as few as possible. We can't prevent them absolutely, just because, you know, there are going to be mistakes, and also because part of this is dependent on what Unicode does, and for all we know, they're going to change rules. But we really, really want that to be as stable as possible. That needs to be one of the core goals. If we think that variants are at all important, then the stability of that variant relationship is at least as important as the variant relationship itself. If we think that we can't add these things in a way that is consistent and predictable, then the answer, the recommendation that we ought to make to in our report is nobody ever gets variants, period, and anybody who wants more than one label, they should just get two labels and be done with it. And that is not something that so far the case study teams have been willing to recommend. But that would be the alternative, as far as I can tell, unless we're able to come up with a mechanism that discourages innovation in this area, but still makes it possible to do, and doesn't require a complete answer for every code point in Unicode from the outset. We've got to come up with something that is in the middle there, or we will just never deliver this. And I think that is the point of the mechanism that I'm suggesting here is the medium that we need to aim at in the report. Say, this is the kind of thing that an implementation needs to come up with. Nevertheless, I agree that we need to be agnostic about the exact details of how it's funded and so on, but I really want some mechanism that is going to discourage innovation.
Carrie, to speak, please.
Carrie, can I take you as the last contributor, because I want to move on to other topics on this call. So, Carrie.
Yeah, I'd just like to call attention to the fact that the Latin script study concluded exactly what you said none of us concluded, and that is that if somebody wants two labels, fine, apply for two labels.
That's true. I guess I was suggesting that nobody, well, it doesn't matter. I agree with you.
When in a hole, Andrew, stop digging. Sorry. Sorry if that came across as rude. Kerry is right, but you're also right in relation to the other case studies. I'd like to move on to item 6 on the agenda, whole string issues. Francisco, would you like to pick this up now? We have 4 more topics to go through and half an hour. So I'm going to, because I think we've spent time on the key ones that we can close or are near closing, so I'm going to be quite ruthless in about 5 to 10 minutes on each of these. Francisco, whole string issues.
Thank you, Dennis. So there are two open issues on this topic, I believe. We have previously the Greek topic about the Motiki and Katarebusa issue on dialectical spellings, difference on spellings in the same language. And now we also have one more topic related to this that was raised by Sarmat about zero-weight non-joiner. I was reading the emails that came through this morning for me on this topic, and on the zero-weight non-joiner issue, I think Andrew is making a very good point on this. The zero-weight non-joiner so far is not allowed, and if we are seeing these kind of issues, the multiplied factor of the zero-weight non-joiner, if it indeed can be placed anywhere in the string, then this is a very good reason not to have it. But in any case, zero-weight non-joiner so far is not allowed, and I think if there is any variant issue related to zero-weight non-joiner, that can be dealt with in the same process for which it's argued that is needed in the root. So what I'm trying to say is I'm proposing to leave aside this zero-weight non-joiner issue, because at this point that's not a character that is allowed in the root, and as such it can be dealt later in the process when it's proposed to be included. This so what do people think about this proposal? And probably some analysis.
Thank you, Francisco. So we take the zero-width non-joiner issue first. Who wants to comment on that?
Armand, I'd like to come in.
Please, Armand, go ahead.
First thing would be to ask, you referred that zero-bit non-joiner is not allowed in the labels. The question is it really part of an RFC or is it just a general understanding but it's really not part of the standard? Because it is allowed in the labels through IDNA protocol. First comment. Comment was, I just sent that on email as well, that yes, it does create a lot of variants, but there are many other things which create a lot of variants as well. Point is that why isolate this particular reason and not block any other reasons which create a lot of variants. That's it for now. Thanks.
Thank you, Sarmad. Anybody else want to come in?
Dennis, can I come in? This is Doc here.
Yes, Doc, please.
Yeah, I'll be very short. I just wanted to say one thing. This problem was discussed in relation to Nepali, and the solution, if Andrew recalls, we came to was that if the environment in which the zero-width joiner or non-joiner is predictable, that means we can reduce it to a rule, we can possibly admit it. But if it is non-predictable, that means it becomes a generic issue, as pointed out by Sarmad in the examples, A, zero with non-joiner, A, B, zero with non-joiner. In that case, I think we should not permit it. This is what we had thought of. Thank you.
Thank you, Doc.
Harold?
First Harold, and then Dagalis.
Zero with joiner and non-joiner are context and dependent characters in IDNA-BIS. Better read exactly what the rules are. I think the comment from Andrew was that the particular example given was invalid because it did not follow with Virama.
Can I come in again?
Yes, if you respond.
Yeah, I'll explain. In the case of Nepali, you can put any amount of grammatical suffixation after a virama. So I cannot predict which character can, or in which environment the virama plus zero with joiner or non-joiner is permissible.
Okay, for Nepali,
it is predictable. That is the reason why we were of the opinion that where it is non-predictable, no rule can apply. It is rather dangerous to allow it.
Agreed. The less non-joiners, the better, my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you both. Vagalis.
Yes, Dennis. I would like Francisco to explain a little more what we'll do about this Cafareus and the Motiki issue that he mentioned. Will this be part of the document or not? Regarding the email that Andrew sent to me a little while ago about it, I think that in the context of this discussion, even the color/color discussion is something that one should address if it's not for Latin, because the users actually are not very well educated about IDNs, and we must make sure for ICANN that it's not going to be a situation that is going to bring embarrassment in a few years because we accidentally provided the same domain to two different registrants. Sorry.
Francisco, do you want to pick that up, the Demotiki Caravusa issue?
Sure. I was trying to close the zero-width generation because I thought that was easier to close.
Yes.
And just trying to reply to Sarmat's question. What I said is zero-width non-joiner is not allowed in the root, not in labels. As far as I can tell, zero-width non-joiner is allowed by IDNA protocol, but it's not allowed in the root by policy. Should I jump into the other topic, or do you want to?
Unless anybody wants to come back further, and we
Hi, Dennis.
The zero,
this is Akshat. I just want to come in.
Who's that?
Akshat.
Akshat, hey, welcome on the call. Yes, please, Akshat, go ahead.
Hi. Initially, when we were drafting the Devanagari report, we had made a list of combinations which were otherwise IDNA protocol valid, but when the meeting took place, even we came to know that those zero-weight non-joiner and joiner are not allowed by the policy, which I guess means that it is not allowed as per the applicant guidebook. And that is the reason why we dropped that case from the report. So I just would like to get it confirmed that it is the applicant guidebook that says that zero-weight joiner will not be allowed in the route. Thank you.
Thank you. Francisco, do you want to take that up?
So what is the question?
The question is it confirmed that it is policy that the zero-width non-joiner will not be permitted in the route?
Andrew, I thought you wanted to talk about this, probably missing something.
Sure, I can talk about this a little bit. This entire issue winds back to very, very old RFCs about how the route zone is going to be managed. And RFC 1123 has in it a statement that TLD names will be alphabetic. And it is not clear whether that is a protocol requirement or a policy requirement, although I read that section of the RFC as being policy. But I know that there are implementations that use that as a test. It turns out that HTTP scans URLs in order to look for the rightmost label in the server portion of the URL in order to determine whether that string is whether that string is an IP address, and in those days it was an IPv4 address, or whether it is a domain name. And this means that the rule needs to be as simple as possible, and the rule needs to be, you know, only letters. Because if you want to internationalize the processing of that, you're just going to put in a new set of rules that put the same test in. That'd be the cleanest way to upgrade all of the code on the internet. And remember, that is what we're talking about here. So the rule needs to be something like that string will be alphabetic. And there is an internet draft that has been circulating for a long time that tries to define what that would mean. And essentially, it boils down to a number of Unicode code properties. And those Unicode code properties would exclude all of the digits and all of the things that are punctuation and all of the things that are things like joiners. And that means that zero with non-joiner and zero with joiner would not be allowed. So that's what is in the internet draft, but it's an internet draft, it's not an RFC. The applicant guidebook included the same text on the principle that seemed to be the direction that the IETF was going. Now the IETF is still working on this, but I expect a rule that comes out that does say something like, the only thing that you can have there are letters. And I think that it's important to understand that the protocol constraints that we have to live within, given all of the other protocols that depend on the DNS, are going to be very, very much more constrictive for the root level than they're going to be for anything else, because all of the rest of the applications always treated the DNS as the DNS root as being somehow special, and that root zone includes all those TLDs. So they do detection of the way the TLDs work, and one of those things is those things need to be alphabetic. That's really the foundation for why things like zero-width non-joiner, and for that matter, digits and hyphen and all the rest of those things are not permitted. They're not permitted for that very reason. This is going to work somewhat unpredictably anyway, because when we put the minus minus and when we put numbers into those labels, there are going to be applications that fail. We know that there are going to be applications that fail because there already are. But I think that we need to be as conservative as possible in changing this rule. And that conservatism ought to extend to things like, how badly do you need this zero-width non-joiner? And so far what I have heard is, well, there are a lot of words that I can't write without zero-width non-joiner, or there are a lot of words I can't write without zero-width joiner. But that's not the requirement here. The requirement is, do you need it? And so far we haven't seen arguments to the effect that there's nobody, that people cannot use this system without those joiners, and that's a reason not to permit them.
Thank you, Andrew. So we should have in the report a clear statement about the origin of this policy rule, just for clarity.
Exactly.
Yes, I'd like to come in.
Is that Sarmad?
Yep.
Sarmad, go ahead.
So I would like to point out that IDNA protocol just... because it uses XN dash dash is already in violation of RFC 1123, so it doesn't hold anymore. And so that argument actually is not substantiated. And therefore, I think zero with non-joiner is as good a candidate as anything else for that root level label.
I think that you're missing the force of the argument. The argument is not, we don't conform to this RFC. Who cares? Lots of people don't conform to RFCs on the Internet. This is a matter of interoperability. And the fact is that we already have a large number of applications on the Internet that do not work with those domains. And we have protocols that are depending on a test that detects whether they're dealing with an IP address. And we need to make that test as easy to implement as possible, or people are going to mess it up. And the as easy to implement as possible is only letters. And so if you're going to internationalize your application, it won't work at all with applications that don't do internationalization. But applications that do internationalization, here's the rule. Check for these properties. And that list of properties needs to be short. Because if it isn't short, then you've got a very complicated test for whether something is an IP address. IP addresses can go just about anywhere that a name can go on the Internet. And IPv4 addresses look just like DNS addresses syntactically. They're a bunch of short things with dots in between. You can't tell the difference unless you're detecting that it's an IP address somehow. And you need something that is short and easy to implement for junior programmers who don't know what they're doing.
Okay. And let's examine the other part of that statement, that there is no demand, no must-have demand for zero-width non-joiners or zero-width joiners. That's a true statement, isn't it, Sarmad?
This is Sarmad. I'd like to come in on that as well.
Yes, please, Sarmad.
I actually am also a member of our national committee, which actually has minuted that this character is needed for labels. So this is, again, a national level consensus. So there is a documented demand for it, at least from Pakistan.
Right. Okay.
For the root zone?
For labels, no. Not for the root zone. But generally for the labels. And the requirement is that basically it is saying that many of the languages which are spoken in Pakistan, cannot their labels cannot be adequately represented without zero-width non-joiner.
The reason I'm jumping on that is because Andrew's argument was strictly and only and totally applicable to the root zone, nothing else.
Right, but so that will constrict possible GTLD applications in these languages if that restriction is put in RootZone as well.
Yes.
Okay. I think there's a very clear point here that may I suggest we continue on the list, trying to tease out to see whether it is practical in any way to accommodate that at this time. It may be something that the conservative approach says we need more time to do. But if I may, Sarmad, I'd like to move on and go back to the Demotiki question. And Francisco, the question to you from Vagelis.
Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. This is Francisco. So I think the question was whether we plan to include the Demotiki Katarebusa issue on the issue report. Short answer is this is what we are discussing, and so there is no definitive answer to that yet. So I would like to open the discussion on that topic. Basically, the main issue we are raising on the main list is the implementability of the of this type of variants. It's questionable. Having to decide what dictionary to use, it's a complicated problem, politically speaking, let's say. And also, I think that would not necessarily solve the issue because there can be things that are not included in a dictionary. The other issue that has been raised is what is this issue that is so special in Greek? Why is this different to any other dialectal difference in other languages? I think I would like to open the for questions at this point.
Thanks, Francisco. Would this be better conducted on the list? Because it seems to be specific, unless anybody jumps up and says otherwise, it seems to be specific to the Greek case, in which case a dialogue between you, Vagelis, and Francisco on the list would be a better use of our time at this point. So unless anybody else jumps up and says, me too, we have this problem, I'm going to ask that we continue this discussion about Demotiki and Katarebusa, whatever it's, is that Katarebusa, beg your pardon, be continued on the list. Okay, hearing nobody, Vagelis and Francisco, can you continue this discussion on the list? And we'll move on, if we can now, please, to operations issues. And Karen, are you going to lead this?
Yes, I can do that.
Thank you.
Okay, so this is a rather complex section of the report in the number of issues that are involved. Some text was sent around a short while ago to the list for you all to read and comment on. The way that it is this section is organized is really in two parts, the first having to do with ICANN's operations and what the impact of having variant TLDs would be on the ICANN operational aspects. And then the second part looks at what the operational impact or issues would be for registry operators and correspondingly with registrars who are operating in those TLDs. So there's some text for both of those sections. The issues around ICANN operations have to do with, the delegation processes, the management of variant TLD labels that are established. To the extent that some labels are blocked or reserved, there needs to be a list or reference maintained for all of those statuses and names that fall into those categories, as well as potentially managing and processing requests for changes to those lists, whether it be adding or removing. Then there's a discussion of contractual provisioning and the issues around what contractual requirements would be needed in the case where variant TLDs exist, what sort of provisions would be required there. And then, you know, again, from the ICANN perspective, looking overall at the security and stability aspects for the DNS, are there additional considerations that ICANN needs to be taking into account? And then the second piece in the registry registrar operations has a number of topics in it. There are a number of functions that TLD registries perform, beginning with DNS resolution of names that are registered, administering the registration process, adding update and transfers, et cetera, of names that are registered. There is a discussion of who is and the issues around who is, changes and updates that might need to be made to accommodate the existence of variant TLDs. Then there's a discussion, some brief discussions on DNSSEC and data escrow, what the issues are around those functions. There is quite a bit of text on rights protection mechanisms. A number of the reports mentioned dispute resolution. So this looks at both existing things like the UDRP and then some of the rights protection mechanisms that are being introduced in the new GTLD program and what the existence of variant TLDs might raise in terms of issues with those. And then finally, what are the particular security or stability considerations that the registries and registrars would need to take into account? We've been through all of the reports and all of the issues that were discussed in those reports in terms of operations, and so those should all be captured here in the way that this is organized. So that's an overview of what's been distributed so far for people to comment on. Dennis?
Thank you very much indeed, Karen. Now, when did that email go out?
It was yesterday my time, so it's been not quite 24 hours.
Sure. So is there anybody on the call who has had an opportunity to read Karen's email and who wants to comment?
This is Joseph here. I've read the report.
Please, Joseph, go ahead.
I just want to comment that this is good, and I'm routinely fall into trap about thinking about whose labels that this report is about into any other IRD issues that is not related to this report. So maybe a few more words to make it clear what is the focus that may help the readers. So we only care about the labels, not any other internationalization strings like addresses and names of the persons.
Right, I understand. Oh. Karen?
Yes, I think I understood the point. You're talking about in who has records that you're not only reflecting the strings and the names registered, but also the contact information and other fields that are present in the who is record.
Yes, just make sure that we bring it to the readers that we only deal with the labels related, IDM labels related issues and not others. Otherwise, people may distract for whatever the reasons.
Okay, thank you.
Just a suggestion, not necessarily that you must put into it.
Thank you, Joseph. No, I think it's wise that we narrow our comments to just the labels. Anybody else want to comment on Karen's email on operations issues? Okay, well, there's a lot of stuff there, so So we'd be very grateful, Karen, I think, if everybody could have a read of this and come back to us with any comments, even short, terse comments to indicate that there's something missing or an issue here, would be very, very helpful. Anything else, Karen, on that?
No, thank you. I would just agree that people should take the time to review it, and comments are appreciated.
And while I have you there, Karen, can you go on to item 9, the evaluation of applications, which is going to be the last thing that we can actually discuss on this call. So, but I think it's an important topic. So could you outline where we are briefly and see if there are any comments?
Certainly. The evaluation section has been sent around in the last couple of weeks, and we've discussed it briefly on the last two calls. The two points that I raised here on the agenda are there because they were topics raised, I think, by Sarmad and Doc of things that might not have been addressed yet. So I wanted to comment on those briefly, starting with the fees, which wasn't in the initial draft I sent around. That has been updated as we've discussed, in the options around code point repertoires. The cost of the process is going to depend largely on, or to a fair extent, on what type of process we adopt for generating and establishing variants. So that there's a set of issues around, to the extent that there are additional costs incurred, what is the right fee model for that. So that text has been added to the evaluation section. Also in the operations section that I just sent out, the issue of registry fees is addressed in that context as well. And then secondly, there was a point on the objection process, and that was also mentioned in the evaluation section that's been out for a while. The essential issue seems to be, we're talking about an existing objection procedure for GTLD applications in which there are four possible grounds for where a formal objection can be filed. And the set of issues that people described in the reports really centered around to what extent a set of variant labels can be separated or always kept together in the case of an objection. And that has implications on, for example, the cost model for the objection process, as well as how you implement the outcomes. So are there possible outcomes where certain labels, one variant label would have, be subject to a determination and the other would not, or something like that, or whether there is a structure where, these are always going to be, a discrete unit, a set of variants. So that's what's the way it's discussed currently. I didn't know if the individuals who raised that had other aspects or other points that they thought were missing, but that's the reason for the point on the agenda.
Thank you, Karen. Now we're at time, and these are both important topics. So I'll take a couple of very quick comments, but encourage people to pick up these points on the list. So anybody want to make a quick comment on either the objection process or the fees issues? Mm-hmm. Okay, hearing none, thank you. I'm sure there'll be a discussion on the list. Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you very much indeed. Now, the next week, mm-hmm. our next conference call next week is our last before our face-to-face meeting. What we hope to do is to get a first rough and ready draft of the whole integrated issues report out sometime next Monday in preparation for that call, and more importantly, in preparation for our face-to-face meeting the following Monday, Tuesday. So we encourage everybody to read that first rough and ready draft, and particularly to discuss it on the list, but also to we'll use that as the focus of our discussion on our call next week, and on hot topics, and more importantly, on our two-day meeting in Marina Del Rey. Again, thank you everybody very much indeed. I'm sorry that we've run out of time, but I found the conversations very helpful and very useful, and we'll talk again next week. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.